And I want to take a moment to recognize our question review team, because this is a moderated conversation, after all. The people responsible...
So the trolls in the audience... too bad.
The people responsible for selecting the questions that I'm going to present to our speakers. So please hold your applause, if you would, until I introduce the entire group. They are Julie Copeland. She's the city editor of the Santa Cruz Sentinel. Fran Gaver, she's attorney with Leach & Walker. Doug McKnight, reporter for KAZU Radio. Jeff Mitchell, he's a senior writer for the Salinas Californian. Kate Moser, she's the reporter for the Monterey County Herald. So thanks to all of you for helping select these questions. So now what I want to do, let me go to the audience questions here. What do you all think of newspaper and news sites paywalls or paid subscriptions, the way the New York Times is doing it? Will they serve to save journalism, Larry?
What worries me about them is if every newspaper had its own paywall, we're going to be sitting there making payment after payment. So what I'm looking for is some kind of a syndication program where I pay once a reasonable fee, if I have to pay a fee, that covers all of the various publications. Personally, I wish I didn't have to pay for the New York Times, but it's very valuable, and so I'm willing to do it. But at the end of the day, it's great that I can get Huffington Post for free. I hope I get to continue.
But can you keep giving this stuff away for free?
Well,
should you?
Absolutely. I think that there are going to be many different business models. And if the New York Times finds that having paywalls works for them, they're making a decision, instead of growing traffic, to have a more certain revenue line through paywalls. And we have made a different decision, which is to grow traffic, and we have overtaken the New York Times. Now, if the New York Times did not have paywalls, maybe we would not have been able to overtake them. So, you know, there are trade-offs. At the same time, a new revenue line is going to be through apps. You know, people are much more used now to paying for especially iPad apps. I mean, we have a new magazine app for the iPad that's coming out on June 14th, which is absolutely gorgeous. It's beautifully designed. It takes, you know, the Huffington Post now has 1,500 stories a day.
1,500 stories a day?
Yes. Now, it's very easy to miss a lot of them, even if you are the editor-in-chief.
Even if you have that thing by the bedside and you wake up in the middle of the night.
So we pick the best of the stories every week, and like, you know, beautiful stones, we put them in a setting, and that's something for which we're going to be charging. But that's a different thing. You know, the web is going to be free. If you want to have everything curated in a beautiful app once a week on Thursday that you can take to bed and read over the weekend.
Take to bed? Ariana told me not to take my devices to bed.
You can make an exception for the Huffington
Post. Right. I get it.
Could we just observe that the newspaper business originally was largely funded by advertising? The subscription fees were a smaller part of the revenue stream, and that has evaporated in many ways. It seems to me there are alternative models. One of them is subscriptions. Another one is sponsorship, which is something that Ariana, I think, is pursuing. But it's very important to recognize that subscription is not necessarily, or even pay-per-view, is not the only way of defraying some of the costs. And there's going to be exploration.
Well, here's a question to this point. How do you get people to click on online ads? It says clearly Google is successful, this person says, but the click-through is actually not the secret sauce for Google advertising revenue, is it?
Yes, it is. Because unless somebody clicks on an ad, we don't get any revenue. We don't charge for ads.
But they're not randomly placed, which is one of the reasons.
No, clearly not.
That
I mean, the whole point is that we try to present ads that will be informationally useful to someone who will care about it. Everyone I talk to says, I never click on Google ads. I said, well, that's really interesting because Google generates $40 billion a year in advertising revenue.
My wife wants to know why she keeps getting all these ads for wrinkle cream. She's very upset about that. She swears she's not going to any place that suggests that.
That would not.
One of the interesting models in ads, Ariana, tell me about this, is personalized ads.
Mm-hmm.
That you will start showing up in the ads that come to your computer. I know somebody who recently had this very thing. An ad showed up for a soccer team.
That's really personalized.
Yes, an ad showed up for a soccer team. His picture was in the ad that came to him from a soccer game he had attended. Is this the future?
I think there are going to be hundreds of different advertising futures. There is a huge rethinking of advertising, and now that brands are beginning to get used to having real measurable results when it comes to their advertising, because remember, for years they had no clue whether buying the very expensive Vanity Fair full page ad was going to be good for them or not. But as they said, they bought it because it might be good for them, and 50%, that was the famous saying, of what they spent in advertising was wasted, but they didn't know which 50%. But now that we can have actually measurable results, this is all going to change. And for me, one of the most exciting advertising revenue models, the one that we are going to be putting a lot of our resources behind, is sponsored sections.
Mm-hmm. Sponsored sections.
Let's take sponsored sections around cause. You know, at the Huffington Post, a big part of our DNA is encouraging people to make a difference. We have a dedicated section called Impact profiles people and not-for-profits that are doing something good that encourage people to get involved. So we, at the same time, have dedicated sections which are about the cause of a particular brand. As an example, Johnson & Johnson, their cause is maternal well-being around the world. So we have a section that they pay for, which is sponsored, called Global Motherhood, sponsored by Johnson & Johnson. It's transparent. It has news, blogs, a combination of everything around this one issue. It can be a section on water, which happens to be Pepsi's cause. But at the same time, a lot of brands now want to have a way to distribute their content, what they produce. So even if it isn't about a cause, it can be about something that the brand cares about.
Larry, play media critic here for just a minute, mm-hmm. and tell us if there's anything in this equation, big corporations sponsoring causes on big places like the Huffington Post.
Well, since you ask, I think that it is beholden on the Huffington Post to have a very, very clean wall between advertising and editorial. I trust you will. It is something that concerns me, the notion of a sponsored editorial, because it does create this chilling effect, I think, in the writers. If someone wanted to write a damning critique of Johnson & Johnson, they might think twice about contributing it to that section, even if you would publish it. So I do worry about the idea of a corporation sponsoring an entire page. At the same time, companies have to figure out a way to stay in business, and we need to be creative. And the whole notion of journalistic ethics is changing. Whether it's changing for the better or not is an interesting question, but it has to adapt. And so I will look at this with an open mind, but I will also look at it with a bit of concern to make sure that you and your bloggers and your advertisers don't abuse this new model.
But actually, there's no way you can abuse this model, because the key here is transparency. Mm-hmm. The key here is to make it very clear this is a sponsored section, and to also make it clear that we have 66 sections and people can write about anything, and there's no way that anything would be censored because there is a sponsor. I think that is absolutely key. And the Chinese wall between editorial and advertising can exist, provided that there is transparency and provided that it's absolutely clear who is writing what.
You okay with this?
I know. As a journalist, I really enjoy having no clue who's going to advertise on the page where my article appears. If I know that there is going to be the same, you know, if I knew that Apple was going to be the company to advertise every time I wrote a technology article, I would have to work really, really hard to make sure that I didn't favor Apple. It is a pressure that I think journalists could do without.
Next question to Vint here from someone in the audience. This is an interesting one. Simple, but very interesting. Can the internet ever fail and go down?
So the answer is yes, but not the whole thing all at once. And it never has, not since we turned it on January 1st, 1983. The net has never totally failed. But to those of you who watched the Egyptian Revolution know that the internet was shut down in Egypt. The way it was done was to shut off all of the underlying transmission capabilities for several days. And my prediction is that if that had gone on much longer, a lot of people would have figured out ways to use Wi-Fi and transborder transmissions and satellite links and everything else to regenerate at least some amount of connectivity in order to recover from that. So it's an extremely distributed, extremely resilient system and has never totally stopped since it was turned on.
Ariana, how about you in China? How are you doing in a place like China where the government is working to create the Great Firewall, it is said in many cases, to restrict access of their citizens to this internet?
They're not the only ones.
And they're not the only ones.
There are 40 countries right now, including the United States, that have interfered with various kinds of ability to reach target
destinations. What's your experience?
The Huffington Post is censored in China.
Yeah. Completely.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you doing?
Same problem with YouTube.
Yeah.
What are you doing? Are you doing anything about that?
We have not done anything. I'm sure that, as you were saying, you know, people who want to get around the censorship can get around in many ways. As we are expanding internationally, you know, the Huffington Post is now in the UK, in Canada, in Quebec, in France. We are launching in Spain on June 6th, then going on to Brazil, India, Japan, etc. We would love to be in China, but this is definitely a big issue, the issue of censorship.
So you might be interested to know that the State Department has sponsored technology to help people break their way through or to tunnel around the censorship. There's a system called Tor, which allows you to do that, and there are others. So there are ways to get out of this. It's just that not all the people online know about how to do that.
And
yet.
In Egypt, by the way, people were using old-fashioned dial-up modems to dial internationally to get on the internet. So people do find a way around it.
Larry, this one's for you. How can the consumer evaluate the quote-unquote information that is on the net?
Boy, that's a tough one. I think consumers really need to have critical thinking skills, and I think we should be teaching that from kindergarten on up. So when you see something online, I don't care where it comes from, even if it has my byline on it, you should look at it with a certain degree of skepticism simply because we should look at everything that way. We should look for multiple sources, or we should look for the credibility. For example, is it an organization who is normally trustable? But even if it is an organization one normally trusts, the New York Times, which is a very reputable
organization. Lots of people don't trust the New York Times.
Well, lots of people don't trust it, and lots of people who do trust it have had specific situations where they've been let down. So again, critical thinking. Anytime something seems too good to be true, it's too good to be true. We had a recent case with the Kony 2012, a wonderful, well-meaning campaign about a warlord who was killing people and is killing people in Uganda. But the way in which that was presented turned out to be a bit misleading, perhaps not deliberately, and a lot of people had to rethink what appeared to be almost an apple pie type of a story. So everything you look at needs to be looked at with a certain degree of skepticism, but hopefully not too much cynicism. And I think I don't want a generation of cynics, but I do want a generation of people who say, prove it to me, and go out and look for multiple truths.
That's easy to say, but it's hard for the average citizen to do, right? Unless you're going to spend a lot of time. I mean, how is someone here who's checking on their device as they're dashing for a plane, a train, a car, what have you, right, supposed to check 12 sources to make sure the story is right?
Here's an example. How many times have you gotten an email from somebody that says, don't click on this thing because, you know, your machine will blow up or the post office is going to start charging for email and blah, blah, blah. There's a website called Snopes, S-N-O-P-E-S, and it's actually well worth spending a moment to go there, type in whatever the headline was of the email that you got, and by and large, if it's one of these silly, crazy things, they'll tell you this is nonsense, that it isn't true. Every once in a while it is, but most of the time it's not. So it doesn't take very long, thanks to good search engines, to figure out whether you've got a piece of bogus information.
All right, here's one. Ariana, in your opinion, should there be any expectation of privacy on the internet?
So again,
this is a
combination of two things. It's first of all us training ourselves and our children about what to put online on our Facebook accounts, on what to tweet about and what not to, because it takes a little training. I mean, I know with my daughters, it took a while for them to realize that what they put on Facebook is not private. But it's private, Mommy. It's just for my friends. No, it's not private.
Did you tell them that the next time they apply for a job, the prospective employer will be looking at their Facebook
right,
page?
Right, exactly. So I think that takes a little bit of training. But beyond that, as we know, there are many, many ways for information to be retrieved, for information to be used, for information to be sold. So we are entering a new world, which is uncertain. We don't really know where this is going to end.
I'm curious. I'd like to turn to the audience and ask a little audience poll question here. When this issue of privacy and the internet is concerned, how many of you are actually worried about your privacy somehow being compromised online?
Everybody.
Sure.
How?
We
all okay. We all right. So that is profound stuff.
Yes, it is.
What do you say to him?
Now, one observation to make is that we're living in a world that we never have lived in before. People can put information up on the net that you didn't have anything to do with. You know, you happen to be caught in somebody's picture.
What can they do to protect themselves?
They can't. That's the problem. I mean, you live in an environment where it's easy for anyone with a mobile to take your picture and put it up on the net. And you won't even know that that's happened until somebody taps you on the shoulder. I mean, I had this happen to me. I was going from the airport in Sao Paulo to the hotel, and security said, don't go on the road, take the helicopter. So I took a helicopter, landed on the front lawn of the hotel. 20 minutes later, I get tapped on the shoulder. Somebody says, you're on YouTube. And I said, you know, what's that? What was that all about? It turned out somebody saw the helicopter landing, thought this was cool, videotaped it with his mobile. And then as I'm getting out, you hear him saying, that's Vint Cerf, and he puts it up on the net. And now we know how Vint Cerf gets around. So, and I remember thinking,
can I get a lift back to the hotel?
Well, fortunately, it wasn't the black helicopter, so it was all right. The point here is that there is not much we can do in a world like this, where it's easy not only for original material like that to get up, but anything that you receive on the net, you can capture the screenshot and put it back up.
It's true that we can't control what other people post about us, and in a way that's a good thing, because I'm sure that President Obama would love to delete plenty of things people have said about him, as would Mitt Romney. And we don't want that to happen. But we can control what we post about ourselves. A,
yes.
We cannot post it. B, we can use the privacy controls, knowing full well that they're not foolproof, that anything that's ever been seen by anybody can be cached and copied. But nevertheless, there are privacy controls, and people who worry about their privacy often are the very people who don't take the time to learn about the controls that are available, whether it's on Facebook or Google+.
You know this better than most. What do you worry about your privacy?
I worry very little about my privacy, but the extent to which I do worry about my privacy, it's what other companies and people are doing and could do, especially if an oppressive government ever goes after Google or Facebook, especially Google, because Google has virtually all my email. It used to have my health information until they dropped that service. There's a lot there, and I worry about what an oppressive government could force Google to release about
me. Ariana, do you worry about your privacy?
You know, I understand the concerns of everybody. They're very legitimate. I personally feel that in my internet role, I want us to be very aware of what is happening, of ways in which we can circumvent efforts to invade people's privacy. I personally don't worry about it, partly because I'm a fatalist. And I tend not to worry about things that are not in my immediate control.
So actually, can I go back to what Larry was worried about? I'm somewhat less worried about what somebody posts about me and pictures and things like that. I'm more worried about information of substance, like my financial information or my medical information, being accidentally released because somebody left their laptop at the airport or they put it on a memory stick and they lost the memory stick. Accidents and mistakes that worry me more than anything else, or maybe a business decision which is harmful because the business decides, well, that information can be monetized and that would be a bad thing. So I do worry about those sorts
of things. And hack attacks. I mean, the fact, what happened to all those Sony networking customers and others.
Back to national security for a minute. We were talking about that. Listen to this quote. This comes from a PBS documentary, a fellow by the name of James Christie, who's a computer crime investigator for the Department of Defense.
Right.
Here's what he said. During the Cold War, we knew who the bad guys were, and they had nuclear weapons. There was a finite group, and there was a deterrent. But now, he says, anybody can buy a computer for $200 or $300, and they have internet connectivity, and these individuals can have a weapon of mass destruction sitting on the desk in their bedroom. I mean, if there's, if he's right, we should be a little bit more worried than you're all suggesting.
I'm wondering what he meant by a weapon of mass destruction. Did he mean a nuclear weapon, or did he mean a cyber weapon?
I'm sure he meant a cyber weapon.
Well, you know, first of all, it is not true that the nuclear threat is over. And it is not true that it was just a finite group. In fact, one of the problems now is that nuclear weapons are much easier to find, hide, transport. So I think that it's not exactly like we've dealt with a nuclear threat and now we're dealing with the cyber security.
He was talking about a cyber threat.
Yes, yeah. But my point is that there are multiple global threats like that. I was just recently at the Skoll Foundation's conference in Oxford, and one of the things that Jeff Skoll has started is a global threats fund, you know, that Larry Brilliant, who used to be at Google, is now running. And there are major threats like that, whether it's the cybersecurity threat, the nuclear threat, which remains, biological threat, different epidemics, you know. There is a whole spectrum of things.
You know, there's a multi-billion dollar industry to try to protect us against these threats. In fact, if anybody here is looking for something to major in, I just came back from the National Cybersecurity Association conference, Alliance conference, and they say that they're going to need like 100,000 cybersecurity professionals in the next few years. So there's a huge industry of people who are going to be trying to deal with these. I'm not saying they're going to be perfect in solving the problem, but it's a cat and mouse game. The bad guys get better and the good guys get better, and hopefully we try to stay at least, you know, not too many steps behind them.
I've got a question for you here, just to be difficult.
Okay.
And fortunately, I can blame this on somebody in the audience. There's no name here. So now with that disclaimer, is it possible for Google not to be evil?
So the answer is yes, and we're not.
Too intrusive? Know too much about me?
No, actually, we don't care much about you.
Well, I don't care much about Google either.
No, in fact, what is of interest to us is not persons, it is patterns. We're interested in patterns because we use the patterns of behavior and the patterns we find in your email and so on to try to figure out whether there's an ad that we can show you that you might click on. That's all that's going on. It's pure pattern matching. It's a computer. Some people have this feeling that there are people at Google, human beings, who are looking at your email trying to figure out which ad to put on there. It's a computer algorithm which we're constantly adjusting to try to learn what you react to well. I mean, if you don't click on anything, then we know that none of the ads we put up were the right ones. And now our machine algorithm tries to figure out, well, why it made that mistake. But this is about patterns. It's not about
people. It's really interesting, Larry, that someone would ask that question, because Google was seen as the great hero, the great, wonderful new invention. But now it's starting to suffer from the giant peering corporation image a little bit.
I remember that before they went public, it was the company that everybody loved. And see, Facebook has an advantage. They were evil from day one in the minds of so many people. But I think I, you know, pretty much agree with Vint. I'm not so much worried about Google being evil. I'm worried about what some future Google management might do, and again worried about what some oppressive government might do with Google's data. But Google is in the business of trying to get us to click on ads, and I think it's fairly straightforward what they're trying to do.
Let me play on the whole ad thing for just a minute. I'll come back to these questions. Arianna, one of the things that the Panetta series has been doing over the course of the year is looking at the revolutions of the 21st century, one of which has been business. Connect the internet and business for me and for us for just a minute and play out that revolution. ComScore estimated that in the fourth quarter of last year, there was about $50 billion worth of e-commerce that was conducted online, up 14%, and it's been up, up, up every year. Clearly, this is the future, or certainly that's part of it. What is the revolution, as you see it, that the internet has brought to our economy?
Well, first of all, we know from everybody's practices how much more shopping we do online. We know from the success of Amazon how much a company can start selling one thing online, in Amazon's case, books, and continue and end up selling practically everything online. I was listening to Jeff Bezos at a Microsoft conference a couple of weeks ago, and he actually said something interesting, which ties everything we've been saying together. First of all, how he was willing to fail, and he encourages people in his company to be willing to try things that are risky and that are not going to work the first time. And anything that is revolutionary, like what's happening now online, is going to involve a high degree of failure. And I think the companies that are going to be most successful in terms of business are the ones that have that kind of culture, because that's how the big innovations happen. And again, to tie in the need to disconnect, Jeff Bezos made the point that he has to disconnect himself and go off completely for 2-3 days at a time. And that's when some of his most innovative ideas have come from. So, you know, it all kind of comes together again. It's like we are dealing with a brave new world, and we don't know all the repercussions, all the unintended consequences, all the snakes in the garden. That's why we have to be very alert, very vigilant, and constantly iterating. I mean, that's for me one of the best things about this culture is the constant iteration. It's not like we have this perfect product and here it is forever. And the same applies to how you monetize it. There are going to be many new ways of monetizing that go way beyond how the internet started, with the big ugly banner ads and all the things that nobody wanted. But just remember one huge shift that has already happened. At the beginning of the internet, the idea was, how can you get as many people as possible to come to your site, right? That's gone. That's no longer the problem anymore. That's no longer the objective. Now it's how many people can you get to take whatever you produce and post it on whatever they have, their site, their blog, their Facebook, to tweet about it. It's basically what Linda Thaler, the advertising executive, called ubiquity is the new exclusivity.
Ubiquity is the new exclusivity.
That's interesting.
Next question to the audience, then.
Well, I'm sorry, could we just pick up one thing about business?
Absolutely. I was going to punctuate it with a question to the audience, but go ahead.
This one has to do with the fact that we've mostly talked about consumer interactions as business, but business-to-business interactions are taking off, and those can be even more automated. So you can do automatic order entry, you can do automatic billing, you can do automatic fulfillment. So we haven't seen anything yet when it comes to the massive amount of business that will be conducted over the net. Business to business will vastly swamp the consumer business in terms of revenue.
And most of the internet users ultimately will not even be people. It'll be machine-to-machine communication.
Exactly.
That's actually where the big internet's
going to be. What do you mean? Explain.
I mean machines talking to machines. I mean a Coke machine telling the server that it needs to be refilled. That's a common application today. We've already seen smart parking meters that interact with server, central server. So machines that are exchanging information with each other. Automotive engineering will be revolutionized by machine-to-machine communications, where the dealer will get everything you need to know as you're driving down the road at 70 miles an hour. All of that is going to take over, and the number.
Well, and our cars are not cars anymore; they're rolling computers.
Absolutely,
and
most of them are not yet rolling internet machines, but they will be very soon.
There's a really interesting app that I found that I love that we have in Washington D.C. called NextBus.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if any of you are familiar with this, but it is the greatest thing. So there are GPS devices or some kind of tracking devices on every bus in the city. And I can go on and I can check next bus. It tells me how many minutes the next bus is from my stop.
Yeah, that's
so when it says 4 minutes, I can walk out and the bus pulls up. It's an amazing thing. It works about 60% of the time.
Public bus, yeah.
So it's almost there, but it's, you know, we strive for perfection. I wanted to ask the audience, how many of you are engaged in some form of social media? LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook?
Wow.
Google Plus.
Okay, Google Plus. Google Plus. How many hands for Google Plus? A few hands. You see, you've gotten some.
Okay, let's all give our Twitter handles. Mine is at Ariana Huff with two F's.
You have a handle?
I'm at Larry Maggot, and I tweeted just before I walked on stage.
Vint?
I'm Vint at Google.com.
I'm at Frank Sesno. It's very boring, but it works. How does that affect business? How does it affect business now that people are communicating directly with one another? They're appraising, reviewing, engaging themselves in this commerce.
Well, I gave the Delta example, and I had a recent example with Chase also where I griped about it and immediately was inundated with
Do you say nice things online, too?
Oh, as a matter of fact, I just said something very nice about Amazon. I was very pleasantly surprised when I had to return a product and there was something complicated, and some human being who spoke perfect English solved my problem. And I was so delighted that... I
think the big news of the night is you got through to a human being.
Absolutely.
How did that happen?
I don't know how it happened. It must have been a bug. But I think that the fact that, as we said earlier, businesses have to pay attention to people. And the fact that the people may have been in the past sort of, you know, swearing and maybe complaining and maybe telling their next door neighbor about things, now they can go on Twitter and Facebook and actually get some attention.
I think that's incredibly important. It's one of the most empowering things that the internet has made possible and social media have made possible. And after all, that's how we started this conversation about the greatest revolution being the empowerment of people who otherwise would not have had a voice. And so now the question is, are we using this new power to bear witness, to complain effectively, to improve things, or are we using it to be massively distracted?
One of the things we haven't talked about here yet, and we should spend more than a couple of seconds on it, is how this technology, how this connectivity is affecting the way we learn. Mm-hmm. Education, teaching, the absorption of information. We have seen suggestions of a revolution, but not the real revolution yet. Sorry. Is one coming?
I think one is in the process of happening, and I think that just as Napster disrupted music, and just as Huffington Post and others disrupted journalism, we are going to see the technology disrupting formal education as we know it. Universities and even K through 12 schools had better be thinking about how they're going to adapt to a future when not only do we not need them to learn, but also we don't necessarily even need them to credential us. So, for example, I recently did a story on technology disrupting education for the Huffington Post, and I pointed out that there's a company where you can go in there and you can document what you know and what you can do. I'm a really good plumber. I know how to program in C++. And they're figuring out ways to actually validate that this guy really is a good plumber. This guy really does program in C++. So if I'm looking for a programmer, rather than go to Stanford or Berkeley or San Jose State or anywhere else, maybe I can go to this website and find a competent person. Universities have to figure out a way to cash in on that and to actually adapt to that. They have to figure out a way to deal with the Khan Academy, which is doing amazing educational videos that are just blowing people's minds away. They've got to figure out a way to deal with that, or they're going to find themselves maybe not doing so well.
Vint, you have some real experience in this.
There's an interesting experience that two guys at Google, Sebastian Thrun, who is the one that designs our cars that drive themselves, and Peter Norvig, the director of research, are adjunct professors at Stanford, and they decided to teach a class on artificial intelligence, but they decided to do it online. And they thought maybe 500 people will sign up. 160,000 people signed up. So the first reaction at this point is, now what? A lot of software later.
It takes a lot of graduate assistants to grade on the ground.
Yes. So a lot of software later, they developed a class that could be taught entirely online. All the questions that were asked could be, you know, automatically checked by a computer, so it was multiple choice.
Did they teach 160,000 people online?
They taught 160,000 people over a course of several weeks. And 20,000 of the 160,000 actually passed the course. And I did some back-of-the-envelope calculation, and I think that's more people than have ever taken artificial intelligence classes in the history of AI since 1960.
You know, when I went to Berkeley, I sometimes had 800 people in my class, and it wouldn't have bothered me if there was another 159,000 people in the room. At some point, you can't pay.
Can I come back to your question of Arianna and to us in general about revolutions?
Yes.
It occurs to me to try to sum this up. Gutenberg's invention gave people the incentive to read and to learn to read, so it pushed literacy. Internet gives people the incentive to write or to produce films or to all these other to express. And I hadn't until tonight put those two things together, and I think that's a dramatic difference because we are now people who generate as well as people who absorb.
That is incredibly important. And you know, this this great sage, Will.i.am, put it best. He said that we used to consume news sitting on a couch, and now we consume news galloping on a horse. We don't just consume it, we sort of share it, we pass it on. It's a much more active involvement.
Yes.
And as Vince said, it's not just even consuming, it's now expressing ourselves. And self-expression is the new entertainment. Mm-hmm. And I think those in the mainstream media who don't recognize that are still puzzled by the fact that so many millions of people are producing content for free, and they don't get that. They think it's exploitation, when in fact it's self-expression. It's like nobody's making them do it. Nobody ever asked, why are people sitting on a couch for 7 hours on end watching bad TV for free? You know, they thought, oh, well, that's entertainment. Why is that entertainment? And why isn't blogging or updating Wikipedia entries or updating your Facebook wall or whatever entertainment, if that's what you want to do? And this, people want to be part of the story of their time.
The only ones
in small ways or big.
The only ones that complain are those of us who used to get paid to do that. Suddenly, yeah. We're competing with millions of people. But I actually agree with you. I think nobody forces you to blog for free, and it is an amazing revolution of communication and the democratization of opinion. I think that's generally a positive thing.
But also, this is by no means taking the place of investigative journalism, of long-form writing of the kind that is still thriving. It's just like that we're all recalibrating.
It's
all
thriving. It's thriving, but you know, and there's another snake, right? You know, Newsweek is sold for a dollar. The publishing industry is collapsing because people are self-publishing, and hardcover books for $37 are becoming a thing of the past as people download their books to their readers or whatever they're using. The music industry isn't a record store anymore. It's better. It's better than when it was a record store, because I can go online and listen to a sample and say, I'll buy that song and not the whole album. But these trade-offs, that's what we're experiencing.
My son is a musician, and my son is a musician, and of course he's not going to make a lot of money selling records anymore, although he is coming out with a CD. But his CD will market his public appearances, will market his concerts, will market his other activities. And I think people are having to find ways to create new business models for themselves. I worry with journalism a little bit, because there has always been a certain, at least theoretical, purity in journalism, that journalists aren't out there hustling and selling and compromising themselves. So I do worry, but on the other hand, I'm not terribly worried, because I do think that things have a way of working out. And I think at the end of this process, this ugly kind of dirty process, something better will emerge.
We've talked about the revolutions of the 21st century in the Panetta series, what that's been doing this year. One of the other ones we looked at was the Middle East. And if we think about the world, this leads to the next question from the audience. The recent Arab Spring uprising was largely coordinated via the net and Twitter, this person writes. Some dictatorial regimes try to control these events to censor them. How can the internet support and enhance freedom and democracy in developing nations?
So in some sense it already has, although I must point out that revolutions like the one, the Arab Springs, don't always turn out the way you hope.
Yes.
Tunisia has worked out pretty well. Egypt is still not so clear, depending on how the elections go. Libya is a whole other example, and Syria is still ongoing. I will say, though, that there is something important to recognize about the influx of mobiles into our communications environment. It's dramatic. It's more dramatic in many ways than the internet. This is the fastest growing phenomenon. 5.5 billion mobiles are in use today. Not all of them are smartphones, not all of them are internet enabled, but at least 20 to 25% are, and that percentage will go up over time. What's important is that the mobile is not only a programmable device running all those apps and everything else. What's important is that it can communicate with the rest of the internet. Mm-hmm. When you tweet, you send one copy of the tweet to a computer on the internet, and it generates the 100,000 copies that go everywhere else. The leveraging effect of being able to get online from anywhere at any time remotely to exercise the horsepower and the information of the internet is what is making that combination so dramatically powerful. I believe that that combination by itself is going to help spread democratic things around the world.
It's important to point out that the internet is a tool. Before we had the internet, we had bullhorns and mimeograph machines, and before that, we had many other ways to communicate, and there have been many revolutions throughout history, many of which happened before we had electricity, let alone internet and mobile. So it is a tool, but I spend a fair amount of time in the Middle East, and everybody I talk to says that the conditions on the ground were ultimately what caused all of the revolutions. It wasn't the internet. The internet simply facilitated and perhaps sped up the process, but didn't create the process.
Of course it didn't create the process, but the facilitation and the acceleration are incredibly significant.
Absolutely.
I mean, the fact that you can so much more easily organize by using Twitter or Facebook, the fact that, as you said, the mobile explosion, which is much more significant around the world than even the internet explosion.
And the revolution, and Clay Shirky argues, who has written a great deal about this, I highly recommend you read him if you have not and you care about this topic, that part, the revolutionary element is, as he says, here comes everybody. It's the everybody to the everybody.
Yes.
It's not the one to the masses,
that's
the
right.
Paper to the masses, the president to the masses.
Although we can do that too.
Yeah,
we can
I mean,
do that
the internet
too.
Does both.
Right,
mm-hmm.
But what the internet has empowered, he argues for the first time, is the everybody to the everybody. That makes it harder to be a dictator or an autocrat.
Well, that's the rising billion. That's the fact that it is, that's the empowerment, that's the bearing witness, that's the fact that it's much harder to be an oppressive, tyrannical regime. You know, it's very interesting. After the Iranian revolution, the Green Revolution, when, of course, social media were so important in disseminating what was happening around the world while CNN and other traditional media had been censored by the regime, China had an uprising, and it learned from what the Iranian government had done and did the exact opposite. It actually censored immediately all the social media, the internet, everything, and instead invited a dozen well-known journalists to the place of the uprising to basically spin them in a traditional oppressive regime way. And this was really a great moment because an oppressive regime knows it's much easier to spin a couple of dozen journalists than to spin millions of people on Twitter and Facebook, etc. And so all the things, just to go back to the Soviet Union, just go back to the Potemkin villages, to the way that they managed to fool so many credentialed journalists. It would have been much harder to fool an entire population of people with mobile phones, eyes, and ears.
All right, I'm going to ask another question that leads to another question of the audience. How many in the audience have written a letter, you know, with handwriting and a stamp, have written a letter in the last 2 weeks?
Wow, look at that.
Oh, that is great.
That's paper.
Okay, but the question is, obviously this person did not have that insight. The question is the post office obsolete?
No.
No.
Somebody's got to deliver those Amazon.com purchases and it's either UPS or Amazon.
This is great. I did some research on the post office before coming here. In the mid-1700s, right, when this republic was first being established, it took about 2 weeks, as much as 14 days, for a letter to go the 109 miles from New York to Philadelphia. It would take months for Ambassador Jefferson to send a letter from France, from Paris, back to Washington. If you were overseas and you wanted to send a letter back to the States, you actually didn't know if it would make it on the ship. So it is the post office, and the post office museum says people would write 5 letters and send them on different ships so they knew it would come back. It was expensive to send a letter, and the typical American colonist received a letter a year.
Wow.
Okay, a letter a year. And now, Ariana, how many emails do you get in a day?
Oh, God, I don't know, it's so funny. The Wall Street Journal is just doing this funny thing of a day off for next week, and they asked me that question. So actually, the day that they were following me around, I think it was over 500.
500 emails in a day, which is why sometimes you can't respond instantly. What does that do to us? How do we deal with all this incoming? Anybody here suffer from email overload?
Okay. I have become famous among my friends and family for not responding to email, not because I don't want to, but I miss it. I literally just don't see it. In the enormous quantity of things that come at me, I just accidentally ignore important messages.
And what impact does this have us, this revolutionary impact have us on us as communicators, as correspondents?
Well, that's precisely why it is so important not to be at the mercy of our email. I think what I find amazing now, again, to compare it to the post office, is the fact that we sometimes feel that we have to respond to each email as we get it, which is really the equivalent of sitting in your office or in your home and the doorbell rings and it's the postman. And every time there's the postman, you feel you have to go get the letter, open the letter, and reply to the letter in real time, like we never did that. But somehow there is this sense of urgency that comes from getting an email. Of course, what's happened now, interestingly enough, is that if you really want to send something in urgent communication, it has to be texting, yes, not email. And people who, I know my colleagues at work, you know, if they really need to get my attention, I may have 200 emails I haven't even looked at.
Well, what do you do with that? So what do you do with that? I mean, you can't possibly respond to that many emails in a day.
I do. I mean, I think...
You do?
Yes, I do. I think it's very simple.
You take your device to bed with you and you do that.
No, I just send incredibly short answers.
Yes,
I think
right.
It's like, I think...
But when do you read and think, and when do you absorb the attachment that someone has sent you and say, oh, Arianna, please read this?
Oh, that's a very good point. What I do is that anything that is like, that has an attachment, or like every week I get updates from the editors who report to me, I just email it to another BlackBerry.
Okay.
Where I can read them, you know, when I have time, because you're not going to be able to absorb a long thing. So my instant communications are instant, things that need a quick response. Anything that is longer, that's why I have 4 BlackBerries. Okay, one of them is just for my daughters, so that at night when I turn off all my devices and charge them in a separate room, not near my bed, has everybody made that point, they have a number so that if something happens and they need to reach me, they can reach me. It's funny because that's one of the excuses people give. You know, somebody has to be able to reach me, I have to have it by my phone. I was talking to Ben Sherwood, who is, you know, the head of ABC News. He said to me, I can't do that. My reporters need to be able to reach me. Get a special number for them. Or the other excuse is, I need the phone or the BlackBerry by my bed as an alarm clock. Mm-hmm. Pottery Barn, $32. Beautiful, vintage looking alarm clocks.
I have a secret. Promise not to tell any of my tech friends. I actually have a landline. And I keep it around for a lot of reasons, including the fact that if the power ever goes out...
You mean a telephone?
It's got a wire, yeah.
I think I saw that in the music. No, people don't call anymore.
Oh, yes, they do. You're in Washington, too. Political calls constantly.
Yeah, that, yeah.
Solicitations and all kinds of other things. Thank God for caller ID.
The fact
you know,
is...
actually, one thing that we have not really touched on, not just here, but generally as a culture, is the impact that the fact that people... don't call anymore, don't answer phone calls from numbers that they don't recognize, has had on polling. You know, we are still like obsessing over polling results.
Yeah.
But we have not really addressed the question, how accurate are they really, given that most sane people refuse to talk to pollsters?
Yeah.
So it's like, who are the people left? I think it must be a very small minority of very bored and lonely Americans. Better to do than talk to strangers. You know, so clearly, shouldn't we really be reevaluating?
Well, we are. I actually know a little bit about that because I'm in the middle of doing a poll, and we're hiring a firm that's doing it online, and they have online panels. Now, I'm sure that has its own set of biases that's being introduced. But the polling industry and the academics that do it have really had to rethink the strategies because
first of all, because people don't have landlines the way they used to. Secondly, because they do look at caller ID, and if there's a number they don't know, they don't pick it up. Thirdly, if and I'm sure you've all been robocalled, if you pick up the phone, if you're vulnerable or lonely and you pick up the phone and there's not somebody there right away because it's an auto dial, you hang right back up.
Yeah.
I do. And I know most people do. So polling has become much more difficult. Is it less reliable as a result?
Well, it's different. And they've had to kind of, you know, rethink the science of polling. And
so when you're doing your poll, how are you getting to the people who wouldn't otherwise be picking
because
up?
Because there is a company, there are a number of companies out there, and Harris uses these, all the big agencies companies use them, that has online panels of individuals who have agreed to participate in these things. And they, you know, I'm trusting that they're doing it accurately, but they are stratifying these samples in such a way that they're getting what they claim to be representative samples of the population that you're trying to poll. And so that is one strategy. I don't know how perfect it is, because even though I, many years ago, got a graduate degree in that field, that was long before internet technology.
Vint, I have a question from the audience here that maybe you can have at, and I invite all the other panelists as well. Can libraries get past copyright issues to digitize books and check them out?
So libraries have already shown an ability to cope with some of that. You'll recall that the big fights over the ability to copy portions of printed material led to the notion of fair use, which is unique in the U.S. I'm not sure that very many other countries have fair use laws. The libraries are our friends in that regard, and they were fought, as you may remember, when Andrew Carnegie was pushing libraries. A lot of the publishers said, that's a terrible idea. People will buy one book, and then we won't make anything out of it. So libraries would still have the problem that we have at Google when we started making arrangements with libraries to scan books and do optical character recognition so they could be discovered. Our purpose was to allow a computer to find the books that had information in it that you were looking for. It wasn't necessarily to make the book available that way. It was to make it discoverable. So libraries could conceivably help, but they will face the same arguments that we've had to cope with under copyright law. And I think the general observation I would make is that copyright in its current form is way too restrictive. The Creative Commons idea that Larry Lessig came up with and other ideas like that open a broad range of alternatives to the creators of these works. It strikes me that we should be stepping back now and thinking more about how, first of all, to allow authors to choose how they want to share their information, not be confined to the current copyright arrangement. But the other problem that we've run into at Google, and anyone else would as well, is that books that are no longer in print are very difficult to, it's very difficult to identify the holder of rights to books that are not in print anymore. And they are not registered. It's not required to register these works in order to validate copyright under the current Berne Convention, which we adopted in 1976. It says basically anytime you create something, you have instant rights to it, even if nobody knows that. And so we have the problem of not knowing even where to turn to clear rights to books that are out of print. We need to fix that, and I think a better regime is to use electronic registration, not only for the primary registration of a work, but also transfer of rights to that work. If that's registered like real estate, it would make it so much easier to find the party that should be compensated if they wish to be compensated. And we just don't do that.
We have just a few minutes remaining, and here's a question, and I think this helps us bring this conversation full circle, look ahead, and to a close. This is a question from someone in our audience here. As a high school teacher, what is the most important thing I should be teaching my students, presumably, about this digital internet world?
Well, I mentioned critical thinking to begin with. The other thing is to realize that specific content is much less relevant than the ability to acquire knowledge and to interpret knowledge. Facts are a commodity. What is precious today is the ability to understand and analyze. So part of critical thinking is the ability to look at the information around you and make some sense of it. And also to be a player, to be a producer. So that in addition to consuming information, go out there and set up your own blog. Create a school blog. Submit something to Huffington Post. Whatever it takes, be an active player in this revolution. And I think that schools need to encourage that. I think schools need to encourage the use of social media inside the classroom so that it's not simply relegated to outside the classroom. And I think teachers need to find ways to embrace this. But again, don't check out. Just because you think the kids may be more tech savvy than you are, you've got some wisdom, and give that to the kids.
We have a minute left. I'd like each of you to take a quick shot at what you see on the horizon, the next big thing that this digital, internet-connected world holds in terms of its promise. Ben?
Three things. First of all, more mobility, higher speed access, more use of artificial intelligence for translation, and then a fourth thing, we're going off the planet. There's an interplanetary internet already in operation, and it's on its way. The next step after that is an interstellar mission to the nearest star, and DARPA is supporting a study to design a spacecraft to do that.
Well, top that, Ariana.
Actually, this is a perfect segue, because while you are saying that the next big challenge is going to be planetary, I think the next big challenge is going to be inside ourselves. I think there are multiple universes inside ourselves, and we need to remember to look at them, and we need to remember not to be distracted by the glories of the internet.
Very briefly, Larry.
I think it gets back to machine-to-machine communication and machines as agents. So instead of machines telling you what to do, they're just going to do it for you.
Bottom line, this revolution has been revolutionary, and it's only just beginning.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whether
That's
here
right.
or on Mars. Larry Magid, Ariana Huffington, Vincent Cerf, thank you all very much. And thanks to all of you at the Panetta Institute. That is what we have time for. I'd like to thank our guests, our wonderful audience, and as always, the Panetta Institute. I'm Frank Sesno. Good evening.